KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. That's workinames.com.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, and I'm here with my co-host, Pat Schlarbaum. Hello, Pat. Thanks for being here.
Hey, I'm glad to be here, especially because it's the start of the KHOI Spring Fun Drive.
It is.
Yes, it is membership week at KHOI, and we're reaching out to our listeners who haven't yet become members of this community radio station. And currently about 400 folks are contributing members to KHOI. But our broadcast signal reaches nearly 400,000 people in this seven-county area of central Iowa. So we'd like to close that gap by adding you to our family right now. And let's have you call 515-292-2878, and we can go from there. We'd like to close the gap by adding you to our family right now.
How do you know if you should join KHOI's family of member supporters?
Well, if you listen only to KHOI, or if KHOI is one of the stations you listen to every day, or if KHOI is your favorite radio station, then you should become a member of the KHOI family.
And it's easy to join, like you said. You can go to the website, khoifm.org, and press the donate link. Or you can call us at 515-292-2878, and a friendly volunteer will take you through the steps of how to donate and become a member.
And, Gail, the basic membership starts at $55. That's about 15 cents a day. Or if you can, donate $100 a year for your membership. Or even better, become one of the special friends of KHOI who donate $250 or more to lay a solid foundation for paying for operations here at the station. You pledge whatever's right for you. If you are a new member and would like a thank you gift, please stop by the station to pick up a coffee mug, and that's here at 410 Douglas across from the Octagon in downtown Ames, and or pledge securely online at khoifm.org. Become a member of KHOI now. You'll feel good knowing you've done the right thing.
And I wanted to let people know that during the Fun Drive, which is starting today,
yeah,
we're the first show,
the
first live show of the Fun Drive. But during the Fun Drive, there are a series of Pantorium sessions. Those are music sessions with amazing local and bands that are passing through the area. And tonight is the first one, and it's a band called Starlight Therapy.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
Works for me.
And that's at 7 p.m. And there's going to be one at 7 p.m. every night during the Fun Drive, and we'll be announcing them regularly. So come by KHOI for some good music tonight and become a member.
So now let's get the show started. We'll be hearing about the Decorah Eagles, improvement in mental health services in Central Iowa, and about the upcoming Foodies and Brew event. So there's not much to say about the weather except that it has been bizarre. Once again, we have a very snowy weekend with blizzard conditions in some parts of Iowa. And today the high will be 34 degrees and still windy. And tomorrow it will warm up to 45, but then on Wednesday there will be more mixed precipitation. Finally, from Thursday through Saturday, it will warm into the 50s and we'll see some sunshine.
Here is a summary of local Iowa news as well as Iowa in national news during the past week, brought to you by the Iowa Informer. Congressman Rod Blum, a Republican who represents Iowa's 1st District, was one of 88 members of the U.S. House of Representatives who signed an April 13th letter urging President Trump to consult and receive authorization from Congress before ordering additional use of U.S. military force in Syria. The Trump administration had been planning missile strikes in the Civil War-torn Middle Eastern nation following a suspected chemical weapon attack by Assad's government on a rebel-held outpost in Douma on April 7th. Blum was the only member of Iowa's congressional delegation to sign the letter demanding congressional approval for the strikes. Congressman David Young, a Republican who represents Iowa's 3rd District, commended Trump for, quote, issuing a much-needed, strong, swift, and targeted response. Senator Joni Ernst, a fellow Republican, likewise praised the, quote, strong and unified response to the Assad regime's recent attacks, making clear that their horrific crimes and use of chemical weapons against their own people will not be tolerated. Trump launched airstrikes in coordination with France and Britain, targeting a scientific research center and 2 suspected chemical weapons storage facilities. Dirk Ringenberg, an Iowa State University teaching assistant and the mayor of the city of Madrid in Boone County, resigned last week as the mayor of Madrid after proposing to dissolve the local police department and allow the county sheriff's office to take over law enforcement duties. The idea was proposed in response to multiple federal lawsuits accusing the city of hiring police officers with a history of misconduct and the police department of failing to keep their behavior in check. Ringenberg himself was named in one of the lawsuits in his capacity as Madrid's mayor. On Thursday, the Iowa Board of Regents approved an Iowa State University plan to expand its sports facilities at an estimated cost of between $65 and $80 million. The project includes a new student athlete academic center, expansion of the Bergstrom football complex, and improvements to Jack Trice Stadium's north end zone entrance. The Bergstrom Complex, a football practice facility, was previously renovated in 2012 for $20.6 million, and a $60 million renovation of Jack Trice Stadium was completed in 2015. The Board of Regents has yet to approve a financing plan for the new project, which ISU says will be covered by the athletic department's operational budget and university donors. On Thursday, Democrats in the Iowa Senate blocked the reappointment of Michael Cormack as chairman of the Iowa Public Employment Relations Board in an expression of their discontent over a law passed by State House Republicans last year taking away public sector unions' collective bargaining rights. The Public Employment Relations Board's responsibilities include overseeing the state's collective bargaining law. A former GOP state representative from Fort Dodge, Cormack was appointed for a second term on the board by Governor Kim Reynolds, although his previous appointment in 2014 by then-Governor Terry Branstad was approved unanimously by the state Senate. This time, all 20 Democratic senators voted against his reappointment, which requires a 2/3 vote from the 50-member upper chamber. The Ames Public Library gained some national attention when it recently announced plans for a 4-day youth workshop in July and August called Camp Drag, a drag workshop for youth. Critics from different parts of the country noticed the Facebook event page and reacted. Eric Erickson, a radio host and former CNN commentator who also used to run Red State, an influential conservative political blog, tweeted, quote, "When the public library becomes another front in the culture war." Greg Halverson, an online radio host, called for a boycott on the workshop's Facebook page, where several others praised the library for supporting inclusive programming. Halverson wrote, "What a disgrace, unconscionable. Ames parents and citizens should pack the library, block the entrance, and refuse to allow this degenerate filth." The workshop will include drag costuming, performance, history, and culture. The library has previously hosted drag shows and has another scheduled for April 21st, co-hosted by the Renegade Arts Collective Burlesque Group and Ames Pride, a local LGBT rights organization founded last year. The drag shows have drawn some criticism, but also strong support from the community. And that is some of the State of Iowa news from last week, brought to you by the Iowa Informer. More stories can be found at iowainformer.com.
Trouble in line, I'm blue, but I won't be blue always, because the sun is gonna shine, Lord, that door someday.
That was Trouble in Mind by Sister Rosetta Tharpe. She is an African-American singer, songwriter, and guitarist who was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame just recently. She's often called the godmother of rock and roll, doing things in the 40s that were later taken up by Elvis, Little Richard, and others.
And over the weekend, I know there's one of your favorites, Gail. Nina Simone was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Also inducted, right?
Yeah. And how about the Moody Blues finally making it too, 40-plus years in the making. And I understand the Cars, Dire Straits, and Bon Jovi kind of filled that out. But so Nina Simone.
Nina Simone and Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI on day one of our spring fun drive. And we're going to include now John Howe. He's the director of the Raptor Resource Project and for the famous Decorah Bald Eagles. John, are you with us?
I am. Good morning.
Yeah,
Good morning.
That was quite a sight with the bald eagles protecting the young hatchlings this weekend in the severe weather.
Oh, yeah, that was amazing. It's not something that we usually see this late into what we're hoping is going to be spring pretty soon. But I think the thing that amazed me the most is it seems that this pair really, they just know how to team up together. We mm-hmm. laugh about how Mom gets her way with Dad Decorah, and I swear at one time yesterday it looked like she came in there and she was about ready to put her shoulder down and push him out of the nest. And it ended up that she just kind of snuggled in there and the wind was blowing and they just both sat there as a team on top of the three growing fast eaglets and just tag teamed in that nasty weather.
You're a pretty strong voice of conservation for bald eagles, John. Now, how was it that you became the director?
Well, Bob Anderson, who started up the Raptor Resource Project, the original director, he approached my father back when he was helping get peregrine falcons back onto the bluffs of the Mississippi River Valley, and Bob had captively bred falcons for release. Initially, he was the one to first breed them for release here in the Midwest. And what they were doing was the peregrine falcon really, in simple terms, forgot where it came from. Mm-hmm. And after release, several years had gone by, and they were being released off of building tops and nest boxes and things like that. And basically they had not returned to the cliff eyries that they historically had been on for centuries up and down the Mississippi River bluffs. And I basically grew up north of La Crescent in a beautiful, beautiful area just north of La Crescent on the bluffs there. And
oh, that's in southeast Minnesota?
Yeah, southeast Minnesota. There was a historic Eyrie there that Bob was approaching my father about.
Oh, an Eyrie is like the where peregrines nest or where raptors.
Right.
The term is an Eyrie. Uh-huh.
Right, right. So he had asked if he could put an S-box there. There was a ledge down on the bluff that had been possibly predated by raccoons, so it wasn't as successful as it could have been. So they did put the nest box up, and each year Bob and the Raptor Resource Project would come and band the young peregrine falcons. And that became pretty much an annual event, kind of a celebration of the return of peregrine falcons after the devastating effects of DDT. So that's how I got to meet Bob. Bob doing his work of helping get the peregrine falcon back onto the cliffs of the Mississippi River Valley. Later after that, we started up a peregrine falcon cam there, and Bob was telling me about the success of the Decor Eagle cam after American Eagle, his partnership film that he did with Neil Reddick.
Yeah, and that started about 2007, as I recall.
Right, right. So that started my involvement with working on bird cams and just going further down that road of helping get. I think, you know, the amazing thing with the Decor Eagle cam was just how people became just enamored with that, the details of the bald eagle, and never seeing those details of what goes on up in an eyrie of a bald eagle.
Yeah, and after Bob's untimely death, then, of course, with your work previously with the cameras, and you were kind of a shoe-in, if you will. And we've all benefited from the technology that you've assisted the Raptor Resource Project with, and now as their director. And so we've had a hatch at the Decora Eagle Nest. Little guys are kind of beyond that fuzzball size of the first week or so, when they're just cute as can be. And
they're getting bigger. They're actually, it's getting to the point now where the fuzz is kind of giving way to their thermal down is starting to come in.
Yeah, yeah, and at a good time. But of course, the parents, at least one, does require to incubate them or keep them warm from the weather elements, and so far so good. So their feet are growing, their beaks, and they're going to kind of approach a romage stage where they're kind of a bit more rough looking, I guess it would be a term to describe them.
I'm watching them on camera right now, and exactly what you said. The oldest one, we've got D29, yeah. D30, and D31, D for Decora.
Yeah, and 31 amazing. For the official count.
Right,
to
right.
This day.
So for 10 years now, about and they lay three eggs. They've laid three eggs each year. Mm. So 10 years of experience with this pair of eagles. I'm looking at those three, and they are getting that thermal down coming in. So even with this cold weather, there's an ice crust over that nest. There's an amazing number of fish that are kind of frozen into the crust of that eagle nest, but they are growing so fast that initial fluffy white feathers and what everybody loves to watch after they hatch is succeeding here to that more gray thermal down that's coming through.
A lot of good things to watch and enjoy for that Decora nest. And let's do a segue into the second nest. I'll kind of call it Decora North. Some interesting developments occurring at that site. Could you bring us up to date with what's unfolded there at the Decora North nest, which would kind of be the backup nest if anything would happen with the cameras there at the fish hatchery?
We basically, in 2015, when the nest tree was taken down, really started an experiment, and that was about 20 yards away from the nest that came down in that microburst storm, Neil Reddick's idea of building a starter nest, a man-made starter nest, to see if we could draw the bald eagles, the Decora pair, to that so they would not move further away from where that nest tree came down. Couple things, you know, we've got the live cam that everybody watches, and the infrastructure that was there for the cameras was close by. So starting that out, we really had no idea whether that was going to be successful or not. So with the popularity of the camera and just all the people that watch it, including classrooms, and the idea of having another nest and another camera that we could show to the public, basically, if something was to happen, which did. I guess the best of both worlds happened. We had our new nest north of Decora, which we call it Decora North Nest, and we also were successful in drawing Mom and Dad Decora at the fish hatchery back to that man-made starter nest. So we had two nests, but very different in ways. We refer to the North Nest is our country eagles. It's out in the farm area, the farm country of Iowa, close to a trout stream. And then we've got the eagles down in Decora. That there's a bike path that goes by there. It's right near an intersection, and people all over the place. So a little bit of difference in you know the proximity of where the eagles are nesting. This year was a little bit of an atypical year, and some amazing things happened there. I guess kind of discouraging at first if you want to look at it that way, but about the time that our female eagle there was going to be laying eggs, we didn't really see that she had productively laid an egg, so it looked like a couple attempts had passed and she did not lay. And then a little bit later in the cycle there, she did lay one egg, and that was pretty much it for that initial time period. She and the male there both started incubating, and about a week and a half went by, and then I think I remember it was on a Friday morning, it just devastated all the watchers that really key in on that nest. The egg you could see had been crushed, and we're not sure exactly what happened, but you know, possibility that it just wasn't formed as well as they typically are, but it got crushed, and it looked like there was not going to be any eaglets or eagle eggs hatching at the Decora North Nest at that time.
Well, and days went by, and there was mating. Well, lo and behold, she laid an egg and kind of stayed right in the process, and then now a second egg.
Right, right. So
things are back on track at Decora North.
And that was really an amazing thing. I mean, I think the question was, had she turned the corner in her egg production cycle, you know, had those hormones that help produce the eggs, and that process had that been shut down, that was quite a ways into the egg laying cycle, a week and a half of incubating. The interesting thing, and what really kind of held the hope up of everyone, was they still were doing all the things that adult bald eagles do to produce eggs. They were copulating regularly, and Sherry Elliott, one of our eagle watchers from early on, was basically watching that in excruciating detail, you know, about each event that was happening there. And so the copulations were occurring. They were doing nestorations and still keeping that nest and doing those activities that typically bald eagles do when they're preparing to lay eggs. And about, you know, I'd say approximately 2 weeks after that time period, I think there was about one or two nights where it looked like she stayed in the nest. And sometimes they give us a little bit of a heads up, and and trick us into thinking that something is happening. So we thought, well, here it goes again. And lo and behold, she went ahead and laid the first egg of a second clutch here. And just yesterday was the second egg. And if she does what she has in the last couple of years that we've been watching this nest, we'll probably be expecting an egg in about another two and a half days.
So there's still a lot to anticipate. Things are kind of back on track at Decorah North. There will be young fledgling, or when the young eaglets learn to fly in July. So it'll be after the Decorah prime nest. But, John, thank you so much for sharing this. I realize we got a lot of details to in the upcoming days. I really appreciate your voice here with the KHOI listeners. Thank you, John Howe.
You're welcome, and good luck with everyone digging out of the snow here in spring.
Yeah.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI, and KHOI is 5 3/4 years old.
And counting. It was on August 15, 2012, that your community radio station went on the air for the first time, and much has happened since then.
We've featured many wonderful shows, talented programmers, and exciting events from our historic Pantorium Studios in downtown Ames.
We've had fun helping to build our community through radio, and we've gotten this far because of our hardworking volunteers and our loyal listeners.
And we especially want to thank our members and supporters who have been providing financial funding, what we need to keep the station on the air. So if you're already a member of KHOI, thank you for your support.
And if you're not yet a member, now is the time to sign up. Basic memberships are just $55 a year. That's about 15 cents a day. So join right now online at khoifm.org.
And there's a special incentive to give to KHOI right now. Several of our loyal listeners have created a $10,000 challenge grant for this fund drive. That means that every dollar you pledge earns a second dollar from the challenge grant, making your money go twice as far.
So join right now online at khoifm.org and click on the donate button, and thank you.
Late in March, the Iowa legislature passed a bill with bipartisan support that will establish 6 facilities or programs across the state to serve as access points for Iowans experiencing mental health crises. This new law is of special interest here in central Iowa because, independent of lawmakers' efforts, Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames has been working with county and regional authorities to plan a facility of just this sort, a medium-term, 3-month residential facility called a Crisis Stabilization and Transitional Living Center. In the next segment, we hear from Mary Greeley's vice president, Neil Loss, about this new facility, which will be located on Hazel Street in Ames. Here's Local Talk reporter Greta Anderson with the interview.
Neil, there have been gradual confirmations of the hospital's plan to open a transitional center or a stabilization center for those who are suffering severe mental health crises.
Correct. We've been dealing with mental health and behavioral health services at Mary Greeley Medical Center for decades upon decades. And as we're seeing a growing need for the continuity of care, so what do they do once they leave the inpatient environment? And we've had a transitional living program in a house within the neighborhood for probably 15 to 20 years now. And we're going to be looking at expanding that program, making it a facility that is also will meet handicap accessibility needs, which our current program does not. And so we'll be looking at a longer length of stay. Currently we do about 5 to 7 days, maybe up to 2 weeks, but now we'll be looking at length of stays to transition people into the community for 2 to 3 months. In addition to that, we're also looking at a short-term length of stay for people who are right now are suffering a bit of a behavioral health or a mental health crisis. And after we do an assessment of them, we'll establish a plan of care, keep them safe in their environment, and then help them get through that crisis, reconnect them with community services, have them assessed by a provider of mental health services, and adjust any medications if we need to. And our hope with that is it'll reduce unnecessary admissions into the hospital and even reduce some of the ER visits, which are kind of a challenging place for behavioral health patients to be comfortable in.
Okay, there's a lot to what you've just said. You're talking about two programs. Yeah. It's been called Crisis Stabilization and Transitional Living Programs. So that second half that you described was the crisis stabilization. Someone presents to the ER, and now you're saying they might not even need to present to the ER. Perhaps maybe it's an emergency phone call to the hotline or something like that?
Well, they will still have to have some form of an assessment done. So they might be in a physician's office, or maybe they're with a mental health counselor in the community, and we would look at what they would provide to us as an information as to relate to whether it's more appropriate for them to go to the crisis center or is it more appropriate for them to come to the emergency department. And so there will be a bit of an evaluation. It's not going to be a walk-in clinic, if you will. It will be a place where people can stay comfortably. We're working with Story County Board of Supervisors for the facility availability. And ultimately, it will be an 8-bed facility that will be able to manage both of these patient populations in a commingling fashion.
Okay, and so is this a new building or perhaps a renovation of an existing building, an actual new facility?
So it is a building that actually the Story County Board of Supervisors owns here in Ames. So it's an existing building that's going to go through some renovations to enhance safety features for patients that will be occupying that. And we're looking at creating programs that are defined within the Iowa Code for crisis stabilization and transitional living, and we're working with the mental health region that we're within as it relates to the payment sources for the patients so that they will be well cared for and their services will be covered.
Where is this place?
One block south of Lincoln Way, right off on Hazel. So close to downtown, and we will have a lease agreement with Story County Board of Supervisors. It used to be Community Life.
Okay.
That the Story County Community Life Program, they had a number of buildings there, and it's one of those buildings that we'll be occupying.
Talk about some of the struggles that you've had providing mental health services to people who show up. Why is this kind of facility necessary right now?
Well, so often mental health services initially started out where people were just kind of put into a facility or institutionalized. And now we're looking at being able to transition that person from an acute hospital stay like we have here, bring them into a safe environment, still provide them therapy and support and observation, activities of daily living, engage them in with therapies in the community, help with housing and all those different things that people struggle with on a daily basis. And we'll be able to keep them in an environment longer for a longer period of time than we could on an inpatient hospital unit, which is quite expensive. So this is a lower cost environment. It keeps people in contact for a longer period of time, and it's covered by the MCO program that the state has put out. Mental health is a growing clinical condition across the country. It's not limited to Iowa. It's not limited to central Iowa. And then part of the other issue, what makes it so challenging, is there aren't enough providers. With this program, we're sitting there trying to do more recruitment. So we did recruit a new psychiatric nurse practitioner that started with us a year ago in July. And we're just trying to bring more resources and more programs that those resources can support.
You have a lot of benefits there, I see, for the patient that they're going to be supervised in a sense. So for their safety, They'll have that oversight. They'll also have the oversight of making sure they're taking medications,
right,
and that those medications can be adjusted, because that acute phase of medication can often be very difficult for a patient. And then at the same time, this will be out there in the community so that they'll be able to start the lives that they want to lead once they get out. I can see that this really will have a lot of benefits for everyone.
Absolutely, because there have been studies that have shown that if we're able to provide that level of supervision and support, support through the program but also support in the community, if we can provide that, people will have less readmissions into hospitals, less ER visits and things like that. So the cost overall is less, and the outcome is better because you have a longer period of time to help the person.
Right, and these are not the mental institutions of yore,
right,
where folks are just sort of given their pills. We've seen that in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, most famously, but not a very stimulating environment for a patient to, you know, be motivated to go out and lead a normal life.
Correct. Yeah, there's been a huge shift in how we care for patients suffering from this illness. And in many regards, I equate it to if somebody has cardiac disease, it's not just something you take care of once. I mean, you have to change your life. You have to change your exercise, your diet, medications, revisits to a cardiologist, or if we're dealing with diabetes or dealing with cancer. There's an ongoing treatment plan, and that's what we're going to be able to provide for these folks is an ongoing treatment plan over a longer period of time.
And so part of your job as the vice president, one of the vice presidents of Mary Greeley, is to get all the pieces in place so that something kind of innovative and new like this can take place. Talk about that.
Well, clearly no one works independently in healthcare, and so we've really been working in a partnership with the region, with Story County and Mary Greeley and key individuals at Mary Greeley trying to put all this together. Right now we're in the phase of developing the programs and all the policy and procedures that the state requires so that we can have the program ultimately accredited through the state. And it really is an effort of a lot of people, and it takes a lot of work. It's not just about, oh, here's a building, let's just start putting people in there. We want to make sure that we have programs for them. We want to make sure that we know exactly how we're going to assess them. We need to make sure that they're going to have the right number of time and visits with a healthcare provider, such as a physician or a nurse practitioner or a licensed therapist. And so we have to make all those programs happen and do the recruitment and the orientation and the education. And then, fortunately, with the county and the region's help, we're making that happen.
Do you find that the policies and procedures that the state have given you, do those seem pretty helpful?
Well, the transitional living ones aren't so much different. It's just a longer period of time because we've had a transitional living program or a house here for a while. Those we feel pretty comfortable with. But the crisis piece, making sure that we're meeting all the expectations for that, there's some interpretive guidelines with that. And so we're reaching out to the state. They got a person there that helps answer questions for as we're developing these programs. And I think a lot of people know that the state is also, or the legislature also approved expansion of stabilization centers in the state of Iowa. And that's a very good thing. We started doing ours independently of that action. And if that's very helpful for us, we'll look into that. We're still trying to get some clarity as to what all that means. But we're moving forward. We're going to have a program that'll meet the state requirements, and we'll provide very good care to these patients.
Yeah, Neil, speaking of a law that was passed late March in the legislature, it was a very popular bill that had bipartisan support. $31 million over 2 years is what they've delegated for this program to expand. It says 6 access centers in the state, and those have not been named yet, but it's possible that Ames might be one of those access points for short-term care for people in crisis. So it seems like we're finally on the right track here in Iowa.
I definitely believe that was a very important thing, and there was a lot of advocacy that went through the Iowa Hospital Association. I was down on Capitol Hill that day and talking to our House representatives because they just had approved that, and it was over to Senate at that point in time. And it is really good. It's good for Iowa. It's good for mental health care. And I think if we can create more access points in this state where people can get help before there is a crisis even, and then once there's a crisis, they get help. And then once there's a transition where they need to go back into their everyday life to whatever that might be, is good for the patient. And whether our service is going to be one of those designated 6, I don't know yet. Whether there's a lot of information we have to find out. We're still committed to doing this. The region is committed to it as well as the county.
And for our listeners, the region is this conglomerate of 10 counties or so, 9 or 10,
yeah,
that all get their mental health services from kind of a single authority and with distributed sites around those counties, right?
Right, yeah. The state did develop a number of regions across the state. And so then they become the kind of the overseer of mental health services within those counties. And then they actually help increase access. They help, they're helping with the definition and the work as it relates to the development of this crisis program and stabilization program. And then also they provide the allocation of funding to meet the needs of the residents within those counties that they are overseeing.
And they figure this kind of program will save them money. You know, they're designating funds for it, so it'll cut down on the costs of other forms of treatment, such as the emergency room.
Right. That's the expectation. And there have been models across the country that have demonstrated that if you provide support at a lower cost and for a longer period of time, your inpatient hospitalization rates will go down and your ER visits go down. I don't know if we have data in Iowa yet to demonstrate that, but enough of us that are working towards this have read that data, and it seems very plausible, because if we can care for up to 8 patients with a lower cost environment and keep them there longer and avoid an expensive inpatient hospitalization or emergency department visit, which do cost more. I mean, that's what they're there for. I think in the long run, it's going to be a lower cost element for the state of Iowa.
And we have spoken with the region about their new mobile crisis response teams, which will also kind of divert folks from that emergency room visit cycle. And then on the county's part, I suppose they're saving money perhaps at the jail in the law enforcement area.
I wouldn't know enough about that, so I really couldn't comment on that piece, but it would seem logical.
They've been willing partners.
Yes, they have been very willing partners, the county has. And I think it's all because of the fact that they feel a significant responsibility for at least the residents of Story County and want to make sure that we give them the best opportunity.
One more question I want to ask. That transitional housing that you say is already in existence, where is it?
It's actually located on the south side of our parking ramp. It's a white house, and it has 3 bedrooms, 1 bathroom, and there's 2 twin beds in each room. So, we have to be careful about gender mixing, and then it's not handicap accessible because the bedrooms are upstairs, and the bathroom is downstairs, so it's not an ideal situation. It's worked well for the period of time that we've had it, but this will be a much better alternative.
Well, thank you very much, Neil. When do you expect this to open?
We are targeting really August is our go-live, assuming that the facility can be ready at that point in time. So we're gearing ourselves up to an August 1st start date. That might slide based on the remodel or redecorating aspects and the safety features that we're putting in.
We can look forward to a new crisis stabilization and transitional living program. Well, those will be located in the same facility?
Yes, in the same facility.
Well, thank you so much, Neil Less of Mary Greeley Hospital.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Now we've been joined by Cindy Hicks, director of Main Street Cultural District, and Ryan Newstrom, the owner of Cornbread Barbecue. And you're here to talk to us about an upcoming event. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
So this event is called Foodies and Brew. So give us the details and tell us what it's going to be.
Well, it's an annual event. This is the 5th year we have held Foodies and Brew. It's a fundraiser for the Main Street Cultural District. You show up. It's all about food and beer and, local restaurants and chefs come together, and it's a little bit of a competition. And then local breweries bring beer. We'll have 16 different types of beer this year, and wow, live music. And it's a fun evening of fundraising for Main Street.
And different food choices and different beers to select from. And you can just go, or I've been to it other years, so you can just go around and sample at different tables. And
Right. When you get there, you get your tasting glass, and the different restaurants and chefs are set up in booths, and you just walk around and sample the different types of food. This year we have 12 different restaurants and chefs. We have Arcadia Cafe, Chef Kevin Terrell and Those Guys, Whiskey River will be there, Jethro's Barbecue, Fairway is sending a chef, Old Main Brewing Company, Watcha Smoke and Barbecue, People like barbecue around here. Wheatsfield, Dublin Bay and Wallabies, the Filling Station, Torrent Brewery, Boone Valley Brewery, and Alluvial Brewing, and of course, cornbread barbecue.
Right, Ryan. So let's talk with you. Is this your first year at Foodies and Brew?
Yeah, because we just opened up our truck window early August of last year, and I think it was actually Foodies and Brew last year was that same weekend we just opened, so we weren't quite ready to do Foodies and Brew yet because it's kind of a big deal. But when I started the business and started planning the business, it was definitely something I wanted to be involved with because it's a great community event.
So what's your specialty? Or Cindy mentioned that will be a number of barbecues. So what will be unique about yours? Or can you tell us?
Well, everything we make is delicious.
I'll second that.
I like to say, no, I'm just kidding. I'm usually pretty modest. But we pride ourselves in everything we make. And I'm actually really excited about what we're going to prepare for Foodies and Brew. I won't give away everything at this point because I do like surprises. But it does involve our award-winning brisket. A lot of people in this community are aware of us, but not a whole lot of people, but we started in the competition barbecue aspect of things and actually worked for 9 years in the competition before taking our competition award-winning barbecue to
the public.
To the public, as it were. The way I joke about it, instead of spending money barbecuing, I'm trying to make money barbecuing because it's not the cheapest hobby. But anyway, we had a lot of success on the barbecue circuit, traveled all around the country, had an awesome time doing that. In 2012, we were fortunate enough of over 7,000 teams that compete on the Kansas City Barbecue Society circuit. We were the national champions in brisket in that same year. It's kind of a big deal. That same year, we also the American Royal World Series of Barbecue, which is in the barbecue world, it's kind of a microculture, as it were. If you're into it, it's like it's your life. It's a big deal, but not everyone knows about it. But there's four majors in barbecue. There's hundreds of contests a year, but there's four majors, and one of those is the American Royal World Series of Barbecue. And over 500 teams compete in it every year, all against each other. And that same year, we were first in brisket, in the brisket category. So those are our big accolades.
Wow. So we're lucky to have this here in Ames now.
We'll be obviously including our brisket, which will actually feature prime grade Angus locally sourced brisket. It will also include a little sampling of our somewhat famous pig candy and then a couple other additions to that. Okay. So,
and kind of a nuts and bolts, Ryan, but what type of wood do you like to use in your barbecue?
With the competition, we used Texas pecan. And not just any pecan, because the way it's said is that the more south you go, the sweeter the pecan gets. And you can actually smell a difference between, more northern varieties, because you can't even – pecan doesn't grow this far north. But down in Missouri, it's not quite as sweet. But you get down into Texas and even southern Texas, and that's where it's best. Wow. And so we actually every year drive down there, fill my pickup with wood, and bring it back up. And obviously we're going to be using a lot more wood with the food service aspect of things, so we won't be doing that. And part of the fun with opening a barbecue restaurant is that you're in the history of barbecue is that all the guys are using what's local around them, around their local region. So, the mesquite comes from western Texas because that's where it grows and that's where mesquite became famous. Hickory is obviously prevalent in the south
Midwest,
and so in the Midwest, so that's where it's grown. Up here, probably white oak or burr oak, those are probably the varieties that we're going to be sourcing for our heat source. And then we also have always used Iowa wild cherry.
Cindy, in the past, Foodies and Brew was held in August, and it was held right out here on near Main Street. But this is a change in date and location, so tell us about that.
So in August, it's really hot, and I don't know if you recall, but a couple of years ago, there was a really bad storm.
I was there that year.
Yes. And so
the tents were blown down.
It was a mess. And really the worst part about that wasn't that we got rained out. It was that our fundraising efforts were stifled by that. Mm-hmm. And so we realized that in order to do some of the things that we do downtown, like plant the flowers and furnish the benches and do the trash cleanup here this year, we're looking at replacing banners, that we needed to make sure that that event was a success and that it didn't get rained out again. And so we started looking for places that we could do that. And of course, the new airport hangar opened up last year. It's very unique and mm-hmm. fun space. So we can open up the hangar door and we can look out.
So you have the feel like
yes.
you're outside.
Yeah,
a bit.
I feel like you're outside, nice. But you're covered. Yeah.
And you mentioned Fun Drive. How do you get tickets?
You can purchase those at amesdowntown.org, or you can walk into the Chamber of Commerce at 304 Main Street and purchase tickets there.
And tickets will also be available
yes,
in advance and at the door.
Yes, so if you buy them in advance, you get a little bit of a break. Uh-huh. If you purchase them at the door, you'll pay a little bit more. But we have to limit the number of tickets we sell because all of the restaurants and breweries donate their food and their beer. And so we limit it at 500. So if you show up the day of and the tickets are gone, you might be out of luck because it's where we have to stop.
And people can find information on the website for the Main Street Cultural District? Is that where they should look?
Yes, again, amesdowntown.org.
Ryan, you were going to also give people some barbecue tips, I've been told, for spring barbecuing.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess probably the biggest tip that I could give to anyone, and I say that it's a budding griller or backyard barbecuer, is to I combine science and the art of barbecue together. I'm kind of a mad scientist in that way. And so I'm a big proponent of using tools to help. And so what I recommend anybody that's getting serious about it is to buy an instant read thermometer that will give you a very quick read on what the inside of your meat that you're cooking mm-hmm. is doing, whether it's a steak, whether it's a big whole pack of brisket that you're cooking, it doesn't matter. The one product I definitely recommend is a ThermoWorks ThermoPen. It gives you like a 2-second read. So you stick it in, it's like, there it is. And because that's important because if you're looking, you ain't cooking. If you've ever heard that, that saying,
you open it up.
You're opening up. Yeah. You're introducing cold air. It stops the cooking process. Uh-huh. And so you want to be able to open it up, see what's happening, and then close it right down. And that's usually why, like when you're barbecuing, you have people with their empty plates waiting in the backyard, and it's not quite done. It's not quite done because you're constantly opening that lid. So keep that lid closed.
Okay.
Use an instant read thermometer, and good luck. And if you have any tips, you can always contact me.
Okay.
I love talking barbecue.
Good to know.
Yeah. All right. So tell us once more the details so people can get it in their calendars.
May 11th, the Municipal Airport Hangar at 2520 Airport Road, 6 to 9 p.m. You can get tickets at amesdowntown.org.
Foodies and Brew. Thank you both for coming in. I've been speaking with Sydney Hicks, director of Main Street Cultural District, and Ryan Newstrom, the owner of Cornbread Barbecue. Thanks.
And we want to close by reminding you again that KHOY is starting our spring fun drive today. You can be among the first to show your gratitude and support for shows like this by becoming a member. Where else can you hear about the Decorah Eagles from the state expert on them, or to hear about local mental health initiatives, and to hear firsthand from a chef who will be at the upcoming Foodies and Brew event? You can go to our website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button, or you can call 515-292-2878 or come by the station here at 410 Douglas and join or make a donation in person.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler, along with Pat Schlaubaum. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to today's show and all of our past shows on our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards. We also heard Trouble in Mind by Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Thanks to our guests, Cindy Hicks and Ryan Newstrom, as well as John Howe and Neil Luss for their interviews. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. So thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.